Chapter 29. Laura. The night before. Friday, 12 a.m. Branston, Connecticut. It's over in minutes. Mere minutes. I've thought about this before, how it can take hours, days, weeks to arrive at this place. Clothes littered on the floor, arms, legs, now limp and twisted together like a pile of dead trees in a ravaged forest. I feel his heart, wild against my chest, breath coming and going in quick bursts, panting. Our naked skin sticks together from the drying sweat, the residue of the heat that is cooling fast. Mere minutes. A tornado, a tsunami. So much drama before its arrival. Then it comes with a force that was fully anticipated. Yet we are still unprepared, taken by surprise, swept away. It leaves us forever altered. The shape of our bodies, the way they respond, the way they move. These intimate details cannot be unrevealed. Mere minutes, and everything is over. I'm stunned. I press my closed eyes into the nape of his neck. I don't want to see his face.
"That was incredible," he says,
and he follows it with a dramatic moan. I think now that it was no more or less incredible than every other time. It's so predictable, and yet I never seem to learn. Another moan, this one manufactured. I know, because his heart has quieted. Then the same hand that, moments before, clenched my ass to pull us together, harder, deeper, now lightly pats my back. Three quick pats that say, "We're done here." I can't bear to face this newest failure. It is bigger than the others because this time I knew, this time I understood. Dr. Brody made sure of that. Don't invent him. Don't fill in the blank spaces with intimacy that does not exist. Don't mistake sex for power. Jonathan Fielding, I made you my confidant. I made you my hero. I let you fill me with love and then take it away. I clench my eyes tighter, but I cannot pretend I don't see the injury I've inflicted upon myself. It's painful and so familiar. Another pat on the back, and this time he pulls his head away, so I have nowhere left to hide my eyes.
"Hey, I have an idea," he says.
His voice is lighthearted now.
"Why don't I order a pizza? I'm starving. We never got dinner."
We lie side by side on top of his black and gray comforter. We lie at an angle across the bed. We have barely made a ruffle. I slip my arm out from under his body, pull out a leg from between his knees. He makes adjustments for me so I can leave him quickly and without any hesitation. "Sure," I say. "I'll be right back." I roll off the bed, leaving him propped up on an elbow, watching. I feel his eyes on my body as I walk across the room. I enter the bathroom and don't turn around until I can hide behind the door. He's seen my ass now, in the light, and I can't get that back. But he hasn't seen the rest of me, and I guard it now with the passion of regret. Behind the door, I turn on the light and push in the lock. Then I run the water. A towel hangs on a hook, and I grab it and wrap it around me like a life preserver. But I cannot be saved. I know that now. I sit on the edge of his ceramic bathtub and let my head fall into the palms of my hands. I try to sort out the moment it all got away from me. God help me, but I find Dr. Brody in my memory. Kevin. Asshole. He used to tell me to close my eyes and see myself as another person, a woman doing the things I do, feeling the things I feel. So I close my eyes now and picture her, that stupid woman, in Jonathan Fielding's kitchen. I hear her tell her story to this stranger, and I ask her why. She makes excuses, but finally faces the truth and makes her confession. She cannot wait for this man to know her. She cannot wait to see if he will love her. She needs to know now. She needs to make it happen. So she takes out her toolbox and looks inside. The story of Mitch Adler is now a hammer, her body a wrench.
She knows how to use them. I see her standing by the counter, wrapped in his arms. There is still time to walk away. He's said as much. He's offered to take her home. She tells me she can feel love just below the surface, just a few more strikes, a few more twists, almost there. Can't you just taste it? Dr. Brody used to ask me what I would say to her if I could. I did say things. I remember them. I said them moments ago in the kitchen. I told her the things I've learned about her, how she is repeating the past, how she knows this night will not end with love, but with sadness. I told her. She knew, but she did it anyway. Jesus, Laura, you knew this would happen. Kevin was not like this. Kevin saw me, and he refused to let me self-destruct. I pushed and pulled and used every tool in that box, but he would not be deterred. Weeks passed before he lay down beside me, and when he did, it was not over in mere minutes. And he did not pat me on the back and order a pizza. Kevin pulled me in closer and said those words I wish didn't exist because I wanted them so much. I love you, Kevin said. And I believed him. Tears come hard now. The weight of my grief is before me. Jonathan Fielding has just shined a bright light square in the middle of it. I want that back. I want to feel arms pulling me tight. I want to hear those words and know they're true. The wanting swallows me whole.
Are you all right in there?
I hear Jonathan say. I hear footsteps and shuffling.
I'm fine,
I call back. He asks me something about the pizza, and I answer something about the pizza. The fucking pizza. I turn off the water. My head throbs from the scotch and the adrenaline and toxins that have been set free from the story of Mitch Adler. This is not the time to revisit the past. I pull water from what's left in the sink as it drains, and I splash it on my face. It stings, but I need it. I need to snap out of it. I look in the mirror, run a finger beneath my eyes to clear the mascara that smudged. Then I run all 10 of them through my hair, tugging at the knots. I tuck it neatly behind my ears and try out a polite smile. First, my mouth, turning up at the corners. Then my eyes squinting just a little. I try a slight raise to my brow. I have a thought to go with the smile. Maybe the mistake isn't over. Maybe it's still happening. Part one, choose a man who can't love you. Part two, reconstruct him into a man who will love you. Part three, make him love you by any means necessary. Part four, fail and feel worthless. Repeat as necessary to stay trapped in your childhood. And here we are. But what if there is a part five? What if that part is what I'm doing now, returning to that place that is dark and lonely, but also feels like home, like where I belong, or where I deserve to be? And what if I was wrong about part one? What if he's not a man who can't love me, but just a man I got drunk with and spilled my guts to and fucked on the first date? I bring back Dr. Brody. It begins with recognition. I see it. I see everything. A wave of hope rushes in, and the smile becomes real. I suddenly know what to do. I open the door and find Jonathan in the bedroom, buttoning his shirt. He turns to face me.
You okay?
He asks again. I smile sheepishly. A little embarrassed. He stops buttoning, tilts his head.
Why?
Isn't it obvious? This is our first date, and I'm standing in your bedroom dressed in a towel. I do not expect you to love me. But maybe you still can. Maybe I haven't ruined it. He smiles back. He picks up a neatly folded pile of clothing from the bed. My clothing. Underwear, bra, dress. Yes, he has folded my underwear. He walks to where I stand and holds out the pile.
Okay, he says. First, here are your clothes. Although I prefer the towel.
He winks, and I am suddenly aware that he is 40.
Second, I've ordered a pizza. So technically it is now our second date.
Ah, I say as though he's just discovered the earth is round. I see.
Feel better?
Actually, I do feel better. His hands take hold of my shoulders and he kisses me somewhere between a peck and what happened on his bed. I close my eyes and let it reach inside, this kiss of reassurance, this kiss of new promises.
I'll dig out some plates and pour us another drink. It's either that or face the hangover that's starting.
Okay, I say now. I'll get dressed. He lets me go and I retreat toward the bathroom again.
By the way, he calls after me, did you notice that I have a bed? That counts as furniture.
Yes, it does, I say cheerfully. But really, he has just reminded me of my list of concerns. The woman who called his name at that first bar, the car, the way he drove us to the harbor, and his job, and this empty apartment after a year of being divorced. I close the bathroom door and reassess. No need to panic. I know there are things that seem wrong. But I also feel that last kiss on my mouth, and I hear him pulling plates from a cupboard for the pizza he's ordered. So I feel better about the night. The jury is out, I decide. It's not easy. I'm bailing water from a sinking boat. I get dressed. I look in the mirror again. Nothing left to do. Then I feel my head pound. I open the medicine cabinet. I don't know why I didn't think to do this before. Furniture is one thing, but a person can't live without toiletries. Toothbrush, toothpaste, mouthwash, shaving cream, and a razor. Though they don't seem like the kind he would use every day. Deodorant. And one bottle of Advil. Men aren't good with these things, I remind myself. Especially when they've been married. They buy what they need when they need it. So maybe this is all he's needed. I open the Advil and shake the pills into my open hand. I will take two, maybe three, then put the rest back. But I don't take any pills. I stare into the palm of my open hand and feel the boat sink. Among the round auburn tablets is something else that's round and gold. I stare at it for a long moment. It's unmistakable. A gold ring. I pick it up and read the inscription on the inner edge. To Jonathan, with love forever. Love. There it is, that evasive word. Only it's not for me. It's never for me. My boat sunk. I drown in this realization. But I'm not going down alone.
Chapter 30. Rosie, present day, Saturday, 10:30 a.m., Branston, Connecticut. Here we go, Rosie said. They had moved to Rosie's car, which was parked outside the diner. Gabe was right beside her. The woman from findlove.com wouldn't give her real name, though Gabe had already found her using her cell phone. Kimmy Taylor, age 37. She picked up after one ring. Hi, she said. She'd been expecting their call. This is Rosie, the woman who emailed you. I'm here with a friend of mine. I have you on speaker. Okay, the woman said cautiously. Then she was silent. This is the friend, Gabe. Sorry to be cryptic on the emails, Gabe said now. We actually have a good friend who went on a date with Here For You. He told her his name was Jonathan Fields, but we know he's also gone by the names Billy Larson and Buck Larkin. We haven't heard from her for a while, so we're a little worried. Gabe played it down. He told Rosie they shouldn't say anything that might make this woman worried about the police getting involved. She could be married, or living with someone, or have a boyfriend, just like Sylvia Emmett, the woman who'd bought a round of drinks at the bar by the harbor. You're right to be worried, Kimmy said. He lies about everything. He used Buck Larson with me, but his real name is none of those. His real name is Edward Riddle. Not exactly the name of a stud. Rosie clutched her phone so tightly, her fingertips were turning white. She did her best to soften her voice.
What can you tell us about him? Anything at all?
The woman let out one quick burst of laughter. Where do I even begin? She said, her voice laden with disgust. You saw his profile, right? Said he was divorced. Said he made over 150K. Said he had no kids and worked in finance. Look, a lot of guys make shit up. They lie about everything from their weight to their height and especially their income. Sometimes they say they're divorced when they're really just separated. I think they have secret meetings, these douchebags, to give and get advice on how to avoid being excluded from search lists. Seriously, I can hear them. Don't say you're not divorced yet. You'll never get laid that way. Makes me want to throw up. Gabe rolled his eyes, and Rosie knew what he was thinking. She was thinking the same thing. Kimmy was one bitter veteran of online dating.
It's horrible, Rosie said. Don't they know that if they keep seeing a woman, she'll find out they were lying from the start?
Kimmy laughed again. They don't give a shit. Are you kidding me? Three dates, a fuck, and they're out of there. On to the next. It's an online free sex buffet, that's what it is. But this one, he knows how to find just what he wants.
So what exactly does he do? Maybe it will help us find our friend, Gabe said.
Well, he lies on the profile. That's the first thing. Lies about his name, lies about being divorced.
Wait, what do you mean?
Rosie asked. I mean he's married. Married with two kids in middle school. Living in Mamaroneck, working as a salesman for energy-efficient windows. Can you imagine? Goes door-to-door performing energy assessments for the electric company, but then he tries to sell people new windows for his company. It's all a scam, just like he is. Finds a way in the door and then fucks people.
How did you find all of this out? Gabe asked.
It took me some time, but things weren't adding up about him. The car he was driving, how cheap he was when we went out. He didn't seem sophisticated enough for finance, you know? He seemed blue-collar to me. And eventually he let his guard down, left the room without his wallet. So I looked. It was that simple. I flipped it open and there it was, his real name and address. I went home and Googled him and whoosh, a tidal wave of bullshit came pouring out. Rosie got the picture, but she needed to connect the dots back to Laura.
How did it start? How did he contact you? Where did you meet?
Seemed benign at first, Kimmy said. He calls to make sure you sound okay, no annoying accents or speech impediments. He asks if your pictures are current, but he does it in a subtle way. He asks about where you were when they were taken and then asks follow-up questions. One of mine was at my niece's graduation, so he asked where she was in college and what year was she in now. Things like that. I knew what he was doing, but I'm sure he thought he was being very slick. Anyway, when he meets, it's always during the week. And to his credit, he doesn't make up excuses about it. Instead, he makes you wonder if he's got other women he's dating on the weekends. Better women who are worthy of a Saturday night. It makes you want to be better, move up the ranks. It's human nature, you know, to compete. And for women, that means being sexier, smarter, better in bed. He knows it. He wants his women to be at the top of their games. Rosie closed her eyes then and thought about Laura. She would fall right into that trap, and she wouldn't even know she was doing it.
I will make you see me. I will make you love me.
That face from the picture when she was a little girl. The image of her with that doctor, climbing Mount Everest.
Where did he take you?
Gabe asked. First date, Thursday night, of course, was at that place by the harbor. The bar on the corner with the shitty food. Gabe nodded at Rosie when she finally opened her eyes again. They had the same guy. There was no doubt now. The next date was on Main Street, more upscale. He got me dinner that time.
Just like Sylvia Emmett, Rosie said to Gabe, muting the phone. The woman from the bar. First planned date at the harbor, last date on Main Street. Dinner.
Gabe nodded silently, then looked back to the phone. He lives near there. Did you know that? Kimmy asked.
Rosie released the mute button. Another woman he dated said that as well, but she didn't know the address because she wouldn't go to his apartment.
Well, she was smarter than I was.
Wait. You went there? You know where he lives? Gabe said.
He reached for his phone, eyes growing wider.
What's the address?
Oh, Christ, let me think. It's in those apartments on Maple Street. There are a few buildings. His was one of the ones in the middle. Had underground parking.
They all have underground parking. All of those buildings. There must be half a dozen.
Gabe was growing impatient.
What about an apartment number or a floor? Anything at all? Was there a doorman or a keypad?
Look, Kimmy said. It was over a year ago, okay? I only went there a few times, and it was late. I was drunk. And after I found out who he was, I wanted to forget. I wanted to forget everything about him.
Gabe was busy now, on his phone.
Rosie took a long breath to slow her mind. She wanted to reach through the phone and shake the information right out of this woman. But then she remembered about Sylvia. About the cruelty. There could be other things Kimmy didn't want to remember.
Okay, Rosie said. Can you tell us what he was like? What it was like to be in his apartment, alone with him?
That's kind of personal, don't you think? Kimmy said, suddenly indignant. Or maybe just defensive.
Nothing like that. I just meant, was his apartment nice? Inviting? Was he nice? Was he a gentleman? Did his mood ever change?
Was he a gentleman? Let me think.
Kimmy was now sarcastic.
Well, he took me on 3 dates before he expected sex. We went to his apartment, which was a total bachelor pad. Nothing in the fridge, everything black and silver. Should have been my first clue. But he said he had just gotten divorced like a month before, so I bought it. It made sense. God, I even offered to help him decorate. Can you believe it? I was such an idiot.
Not at all, Rosie said. It sounds like he was very good at what he did. Conning women.
You have no idea. He knew exactly what to say to me, exactly how to get inside my head. He talked about his dead father because my father had died when I was young. He talked about living life for the moment because you never know when it will end. Again, something I was drawn to because of my father's young death. And he made me feel like I was the first woman he'd been with since his cold ex-wife, who didn't sleep with him for years. The thing is, the reason I started to wonder about him, if you can believe it, was how he was in bed. I mean, a man who's been in a shitty marriage for 10 years and who hasn't had sex for a long time and is now at the free sex buffet, you would think he would be a little eager beaver, quick on the draw, you know what I'm saying?
Yes, Rosie said. Imagining Joe after going 4 months around the time of Mason's birth. He was like a man in the desert, suddenly finding an oasis. But he wasn't like that? Rosie asked.
No, he has it all down to a routine. He goes for a quickie off the bat, like he's trying things out. A shark taking that first bite, getting a taste before coming back for the kill. So he made excuses for me to stay so he could go again, go in for the kill. And that's when things got strange. It started with dirty talk, really filthy stuff. And then he got demanding. Some of the things he wanted to do. Well, I'm sure he found other women willing to do them to get a Saturday night date. But I wasn't into it. I left feeling disgusted. But it didn't stop me from coming back again. I came back for one last date, and that was when I found out the truth. He left the bedroom to get another drink, and I pulled his wallet out of his pants pocket. When he came back, I was dressed and heading for the door. I made up some story about a friend who was drunk and stranded at a bar. He didn't care a whole lot. Walked me to the door. No kiss, no nothing. He didn't get his second round, so he was disappointed. I swear to you, I sometimes wonder what would have happened if I hadn't found the wallet. If I'd stayed for the second round that time. It felt like he knew exactly what he wanted at each turn and that he was going to find a way to get it.
Gabe looked up from his phone. Distracted and seemingly unaffected by a story that Rosie found horrific and eerily similar to that of Sylvia Emmett's.
Can I text you some pictures of apartment buildings on Maple? If we drive there now, maybe you can tell us which one looks like his. Maybe you'll remember the number or the floor.
There was a long silence. Hello, Rosie said. You still there?
Yeah, Kimmy said with a sigh. I can pull up images on my computer. I can probably find it for you. Jesus, though, don't tell him we spoke, okay? I would hate for him to think that I gave him even 1 second of thought after I walked out that door.
Of course, Rosie said.
And when you find the right building, it's apartment 2L. I remember it.
I remember thinking that L stands for liar.
Chapter 31. Laura. Session number 10. 2 months ago. New York City. Laura. I've been thinking about what you said, about there being someone from my past I tried to fix. Dr. Brody.
Yes, I remember when I said that.
Laura. It's my father, right? The first man a girl loves? Dr. Brody.
And the one who loves her back, who teaches her she's worthy of love.
Laura. I can see that. Only it wasn't my father who was broken, it was my mother. He cheated on her, left her for another woman. She was always crying, worrying, and she didn't hide it well. She used to talk about it in the kitchen with Mrs. Wallace and anyone else she could lure inside. Dr. Brody.
Sometimes things aren't what they seem, especially when they're things from when we were young. Our memories are not static, they're not pictures of reality. Sometimes they're not true at all, but rather fiction that we need to believe so we can make sense of things.
Laura. So my father wasn't the bad guy? My mother wasn't the victim? Dr. Brody.
You told me a story about something you overheard, something your father said to your sister that night he left. It's the only story that doesn't fit with the narrative, and yet it stands out enough that you told it to me.
Laura. I was listening at the door. Rosie was mad at him for leaving, yelling at him. And he said to her, and this I know is exactly what happened. He said, your mother is no saint. Dr. Brody.
Something happened, Laura. Something no one told you or Rosie. But I have a feeling you knew inside, even as a little girl, that your father was the one who was broken.
Laura. The one I tried to fix so he could love me? I learned all of this from my father? Dr. Brody.
It's almost always the case, Laura. With women who seek men who won't love them and turn away from the ones who can and do.
Laura. I think I hate him even more now. Dr. Brody.
Except you don't. And you need to find out why.
Chapter 32. Laura. The night before. Friday, 12:45 a.m. Branston, Connecticut. So about that hangover situation, I say to Jonathan Fielding. I'm dressed, but still feel naked. It's Rosie's dress. I hate dresses. I hate the way the air feels against my legs, how it creeps beneath the hemline and makes its way up as far as it pleases, sometimes all the way to the sleeves. I hate my bare feet and loose hair falling around my face, sticking to the back of my neck. I hate a lot of things right now. Jonathan hands me a glass of scotch from the other side of the kitchen counter. I am close to the door. My purse is right in front of me. I left my shoes in the small foyer, but they are gone now. Probably moved to a closet where I can't find them without more delay, more chances to work his way into my brain. No matter. I don't need shoes to get home. Home, I think now. Rosie and Joe and Mason. My cozy space in the attic, hiding beneath the fluffy comforter. Home, I think again. Only it's not my home. It's Rosie's and Joe's and Mason's. And the attic is where I found the last of the three notes. Not so cozy after all. I have no home. That's the truth. But that still doesn't make this a place I want to stay 1 minute longer. I take the drink and swallow it down.
So what is this about the hangover? Jonathan asks.
He's smiling like we are lovers, and I suppose we are, technically. The way that phrase is used. Lovers. Home. Just words. Stupid, meaningless words. Yeah, I begin. I've swallowed the rage and turned it to steel. So I thought I'd preempt it with something more medically sound than more alcohol.
Oh?
He asks.
and I see a trace of concern. That's right, Jonathan. It's your turn to worry. I figured some Advil might be in order. Luckily, I found some. My voice is cheery. He seems relieved.
Oh, good. I'm glad. I don't have a lot of medicines in there. I don't really like to take things, and I haven't been sick for a long time. God, my ex used to keep everything.
Funny you should mention her, I say.
My ex? I'm sorry. I guess that is a little insensitive after the night we've had.
I study his eyes then, and he studies mine. He is looking for clues about what's inside my head. I have the upper hand because I know. I lift up my left hand and turn it backward, so the palm faces me, and the bright gold ring on my finger faces him. Did you want to put this back on before you go home? Jonathan freezes. He's so still that I wonder if I should check for a pulse. He freezes like he's been dipped in liquid nitrogen. I say nothing. I do nothing. Rage is steel, and it makes me feel strong. I haven't felt strong in a very long time, and I would be a liar if I said I didn't like it. I would be a liar just like Jonathan Fielding.
Laura.
Finally, he speaks, but only this one word makes it past his lips. I pull the ring off my finger and place it on the counter.
It's not what you think, he says.
His defrosting face is forlorn, but not regretful. It's not guilty either, and this lets confusion slip past the steel gates.
I know you've noticed a lot of things tonight. You've been polite not to bring them up. You've been trusting and forthcoming, and I feel like a complete shit.
Your car, I say, now that he's opened the door.
Yes, the Toyota that looks like a throwback to the 1980s, only it's brand new.
And your job.
Right again. I don't work in Branston. What 40-year-old divorced hedge fund manager would work out here when he could be in Manhattan? Right again.
The bare apartment? The woman from the bar? He looks away to take a long drink of scotch. He sets the glass back down on the counter. Then he picks up the ring and twists it between his fingers.
The woman from the bar is who I said she was, a crazy stalker who bothered my ex-wife after I stopped seeing her a few weeks ago. That was the truth.
And the apartment is new. I moved in at the end of the summer. My mind is spinning as it processes this new information. He's admitted things but given no explanations, and he's avoided the biggest one of all, the one that's moved to the top of my list. The ring. The fucking wedding ring he keeps hidden in a bottle of Advil in his empty apartment where he brings other women. There is something about what now sits between us. Facts without a conclusion. Facts without the truth. It's a puzzle with missing pieces, the important ones that leave nothing but ambiguity in their absence. The steel begins to melt, the strength subsiding now. I can't do this, I say. Tears come fast, giant sobs follow. And the words fly out in broken pieces, cutting me like little shards of glass. You're married, sob. You lied about everything. You're lying now, sob. Whatever you say, I won't know how much of it is a lie, because you'll sprinkle in small truths, little admissions that aren't fatal, but instead give you credibility, because why would you say them at all if they cast you in a bad light? I know how this goes, sob. I've been here before. I've been with the best of them, better than you. Hysteria sets in. Jonathan's face freezes. The rage is now liquid that seeps from my skin. I know he can see it. How can you do this to people? It's cruel. It's so fucking cruel. That word is new to me. It's a word I learned from Dr. Brody. Can't you see his cruelty? He was talking about another liar, another man I tried to make love me, a man who bled to death at my feet, Mitch Adler. Liar. Cruel, cruel liar. I see it now, Kevin. I see the cruelty.
Hold on a minute, Jonathan says.
He moves away from the counter and leans against the refrigerator. We've been here before.
Things moved fast tonight, faster than either of us anticipated. Yes, I told some white lies because I'm trying to meet people here, but it's far from cruel. Honestly, you're way off base.
Adrenaline now. Rage becomes fear. What the hell is this? A cover-up? Or have I done it again? She's so hard to love with her mountains for molehills.
Can I explain? Please, will you do me that courtesy?
I wipe my eyes. I hold my breath. Maybe I will die if I hold it long enough.
Okay, I'm going to start from the beginning. Are you good? Have your drink.
He doesn't move closer to me. I wish I could move farther away. I hold my drink, take a sip. The adrenaline kills it the moment it hits my blood.
I'm from Boston. You already know that.
Is your mother really dead? I blurt out. If we're starting from the beginning, I want to know every lie, every single one of them.
Yes, all of that. The man who drowned, my sister, my parents, and how I met my wife. All of it's true. And we did move to New York, and we did live out here. She kept the house. It's on Blackberry Drive, way up north and on the west side. I don't know why she wants to live there, but she does. It's not my problem anymore. I hated that house, hated the commute.
So you did work in New York?
Yes, I worked in New York. The name of the firm is Claiborne Capital. It's a small hedge fund. The headquarters are in Boston, but they have offices in New York and London. When I got divorced, I didn't stay here. You were right about that. I moved back to Boston. I worked at the office there and lived with my father for a while. I was broken, truly broken. I still loved her, and I wanted the family we tried so hard to have.
So that's the first lie, that you stayed here?
Yes, that's the first lie.
I finish my drink and pretend to be indignant. Ha, he's admitted to a lie. But it's so small. It's a little baby lie, and babies can't be cruel, not intentionally.
Okay, I say. Go on.
He does, and I can see his demeanor change. He knows he has me. He knows what's coming are just more baby lies, a cute little nursery school of lies.
After about 6 months, they asked me to transfer back. They want to have an office in Branston for some of the older partners who have families here. It's a better lifestyle. They asked me to open it. 1 year, that's what they said. And then I can have my choice. Stay here, work in New York, or go back to Boston.
So you just came back. That's why there's no furniture.
Yes. I've only been back for 7 weeks, which is why I don't know my way around downtown. We never went to the harbor when I lived up north. I've spent 4 weeks in a hotel, 3 in this apartment, which I've subleased for now, off the books, so who knows how long I can keep it. I can't decide what I want to do. Move to New York, go back to Boston, and I'm working all the time.
And the car?
A loaner. I do have a BMW. It's in the shop. They were going to charge me for one of theirs, so I just got this one for the week. I should have said that from the start, but you didn't ask, and I didn't want to just blurt it out.
God. I need Dr. Brody. I need Kevin. How do I know what to believe? Yes, I have a heightened sense of perception, but then I never know what to do with the information. This is all so convenient, so perfect. And yet it all adds up like 2 + 2 = 4.
The ring,
he says suddenly.
The last question, right?
For now, I say. I try to be smug, self-righteous. But all I've got are these baby lies.
Everything I own is in this apartment building. I can show you the storage unit in the basement, boxes of winter clothes, some pictures and photo albums. Everything I have is from my adult life, and that involves my wife. My childhood things are at my father's house. So, what to do with this?
He twists the ring between his fingers again, and I stare at it with remorse for my rage and longing for what it represents.
I couldn't leave it in the basement. I don't want it to get stolen, and I don't have a safe. I read somewhere that a pill bottle is a better place to hide valuables than socks, so that's where I put it. I wasn't expecting company, not like this. Not to the point where it caused a headache.
Now he's trying to be cute. I don't know if I like it. I can't even decide if it's real. But something comes through loud and clear. He wants me to stay. He wants me to believe him. It would have been so easy to shrug and let me storm off.
Maybe he's afraid he'd have another stalker on his hands. Or maybe he's afraid of losing whatever it is we've begun. Someone tell me. Please. Someone tell me which it is before I lose my mind. The rage is turning inward, turning on me now because I am so incompetent.
Laura, he says.
And he walks back to the counter.
I know you probably want to leave. I know some of this sounds too convenient. But will you do me one favor before you go? And then I promise I will walk you to your car.
I don't say yes. I don't say no. The tears are behind my eyes again, the sobs choking my throat. So I stand there like an idiot and shake my head.
Okay, let me get my laptop from the bedroom. We are going to Google the shit out of me and my ex-wife and my firm. I even have an email from the BMW shop. Will you do that with me? Will you let me show you?
What is going on here? Somebody tell me. The doorbell rings then, and I jump back, startled. We look at each other for a second, and then his eyes light up, big and wide and bright.
The pizza,
he says, like a little boy. He claps his hands with excitement. He walks around the counter, behind where I stand, and opens the door.
Chapter 33. Rosie, present day, Saturday, 11 a.m., Branston, Connecticut. Rosie followed Gabe to Maple Street. Kimmy Taylor had recognized the entrance from the pictures he'd sent and the ones she'd found on the internet. Gabe knew which building it was, and she was certain of the number, 2L. L is for liar, she'd said. Joe called three times along the way, but Rosie couldn't talk to him. Not yet. Not now, when they were so close to finding Laura. She sent a text with a lie. I'm stopping by the police station, then coming home. If she told him about the apartment, he'd already be here. Only now she didn't know if he'd be here for her or for Laura. A few hours ago, she wouldn't have minded either way, but everything had changed. His name was Joe. She rushed from her car to catch up with Gabe. He was moving fast. I called the police, he said. Told them to meet us here. Rosie walked beside him, trying to keep up with his long strides. What did they say? They got to the front door and stopped. Gabe pulled out his phone and looked at the picture, then back at the door. This is the one, he said. Are they coming? Rosie asked. The police? Gabe nodded. Yeah. What did they say? Did you speak to the officers who came yesterday? Conway. I spoke to Conway. He said to wait outside. Gabe looked at her then, inquisitively. To hell with that, Rosie answered. Agreed. Gabe pulled on the door, but it was locked. A panel of black buttons was on the right side of the entrance. Gabe pushed them one at a time until a voice came out of the panel.
Hello,
a woman said.
UPS, he said.
Amazon?
The woman asked.
Yeah,
Gabe answered. Then the buzzer. Rosie pulled the door open and rushed inside.
That's so scary,
she said to Gabe, who followed right behind.
You have no idea, but I guess that's why people live here, so they can afford to be trusting.
Neither of them spoke as they climbed the stairs to the second floor, then down the long hallway, following the letters on the doors. When they got to 2L, Gabe grabbed her arm, stopping her. He pressed a finger to his lips, telling her to be quiet.
What?
Rosie whispered.
Take a second, okay? You haven't slept or eaten. We need to think. We should have a plan.
Rosie knew what she looked like. She'd seen herself in the window of that hotel in New York, and again in the rearview mirror of her car. But Laura could be on the other side of that door, and nothing else mattered until she knew. Gabe was suddenly in control, the way Joe used to be when they were children. But Joe wasn't here, so Gabe had stepped in, doing the thinking and the executing of the plan. And thank God, because Rosie didn't have the ability for either of those now.
Nothing was going to stop her from getting inside that apartment and finding her sister.
Gabe laid it out. What if he answers, and she's not there? What if he lies and says he has no idea who she is? What if he says they had a drink and she left right after?
He spoke evenly as they stood in the hallway, but Rosie couldn't calm herself. I don't know, Gabe. I just need to get on the other side of that door.
Rosie felt her cheeks flush. Her head was light, but somehow hard to keep steady.
I have to get inside that apartment. I have to know what's happened to my sister.
The elevator door opened then. Rosie and Gabe turned their heads when they heard the chime. Officers Pearson and Conway emerged, finding them in the hallway. Rosie ran to meet them. She took Pearson by the arm and pulled her along.
He's there, she said. The man my sister was with. He lives in that apartment.
Okay, Mrs. Farrow.
Pearson was condescending, even just saying her name. Rosie still had her by the arm, but it was like pulling dead weight.
It's him. His name is Edward Riddle. He lies about it, calls himself all different names. He's married and has children. He uses this apartment to be with women from that website.
Rosie could hear herself. She knew she sounded crazy. She knew she looked crazy. She could see herself in the expressions of all of them. Pearson, Conway, and even Gabe. And she could see Gabe waiting for her to tell them the rest of it. About the threatening notes, or how Laura had been sleeping with her therapist in New York. Also married. Also with children. And now, dead. But she stopped herself when they reached the front of the door. She looked at Gabe to make sure he wasn't going to say a word about any of that. It would do nothing but distract them, make them worry less about her sister than this horrible man who lied and cheated and misused women any way he could. If he hurt Laura, and if she hurt him back, God help her. But Rosie felt he deserved it. Pearson looked at Conway for a signal. Conway gave it.
Look, we don't have a warrant for his apartment. We don't even have probable cause for a warrant. We can knock, ask a few polite questions, but that's it.
Rosie felt her eyes widen. The air stung when it hit them. Her mouth was bone dry, her head throbbing, and inside her chest was the weight of a scream desperate to come out. She took two steps to the door and pounded her fist.
Laura! She yelled. Laura!
Conway was now beside her.
That's enough, he said.
He moved in front of her, blocking her from the door.
Mr. Riddle,
he said as he knocked firmly.
It's the police. We just have a few questions.
Silence descended across the hallway. Conway pressed his ear to the door, standing just beside it. He motioned for Pearson to get Rosie, which she did, and Rosie realized they were keeping clear in case someone fired a weapon from inside. Conway knocked again. Still, no answer. Not a sound.
Knock it down, Rosie said, looking back and forth between the officers and Gabe. What is wrong with all of you? Laura could be inside.
Conway backed away from the door.
We don't have a warrant. We aren't knocking down any doors.
Rosie looked at Gabe now, desperate for help.
They never should have called the police. If they were alone, Gabe would find a way inside that door. She knew he would.
Pearson got a text.
Hold on a second, she said to them as she read it. Okay, the apartment is leased to a company. Someone is reaching out to them to find out who lives here.
A company? What kind of company?
Rosie asked.
It's an LLC, probably a real estate holding company.
They were all trying to calm Rosie down. But she didn't want to be calm. She wanted to get into that apartment.
Gabe explained it to her. People do that all the time, Rosie. For tax reasons, to limit liability. It costs nothing to start an LLC.
He did it to hide. I know it. He's hiding it from his wife. Can't we search the names associated with the LLC?
We're doing that as well, Pearson said.
Rosie looked back to the door of apartment 2L. They were trying to distract her with all of these things they were doing, but really they weren't doing anything but stalling.
What about the manager? Rosie asked. Maybe he'll let us in. Wouldn't he have a key?
Mrs. Farrow, that's the same as breaking the door down. We don't have probable cause to do that. Once we get the name of the party living here, and if we can verify that your sister went on a date with him Thursday night, then we can apply for a warrant.
And how long will that take? Days? A week? My sister has been missing since Thursday.
Pearson glanced at Conway, who nodded.
What?
Rosie asked. They were holding something back.
We got the phone records. They came in this morning. We called your house and told your husband.
I've been out all morning. He didn't say anything. Why didn't you call me on my cell phone?
Rosie couldn't believe that Joe would keep that from her. But then again, she hadn't been taking his calls.
We assumed he would tell you. He didn't mention you were out. Where were you?
Conway asked. Rosie tried, but she couldn't steady herself. Nothing was making sense anymore.
I was driving around looking for my sister,
she lied. Gabe shot her a look, but she ignored it. She was doing exactly that, driving and searching for Laura. They didn't ask where.
What did you find? On her phone?
The last few calls were from a number registered to a business, a financial investment firm in New York, Pearson answered.
Can you get the name of the employee? Jesus, don't you see the connection? The apartment is leased under an LLC. The phone is registered to a business in New York. This guy does not want to be traced. He doesn't want to be found.
We're now looking into both companies, trying to find the right people to give us that information.
Don't tell me. You have to wait until Monday, right?
No need to bother anyone on the weekend. After all, it's only been a day and a half. She's probably just run off with him for the weekend, right? Too afraid to tell her crazy sister?
Gabe was the one who answered. Rosie, that's not true. These things take time to track down.
What about other numbers on her phone?
Pearson took out her phone again and pulled up the scanned record. Here, you tell us, Pearson said, handing her the phone. Rosie grabbed it and started to scan the numbers. She mumbled her thoughts as she began to recognize them. 917-28, that's her old work cell phone. 212-23, that's the firm's landline. Scrolling more, reading with bleary eyes. 203-35. She stopped suddenly, staring at that last number. Then she began counting, scrolling and counting the number of times she saw those digits.
203-35. Can you get the text messages that were written?
She asked.
We should have them later this morning. Is there a number you recognize?
Conway asked.
All heads turned when a door opened. It was 2M, right beside Edward Riddle's.
A middle-aged woman with a small dog emerged, stopping short when she saw the police officers.
What's going on out here? She asked.
Conway smiled politely.
Everything's fine. Do you know the tenants in 2L?
He asked.
Eddie.
Yeah, I know him, she said, rolling her eyes.
But then her face grew concerned.
Why? Is he in trouble? She asked.
No, we're just trying to find someone he might know.
A woman, right?
Rosie was about to spring into action, but Gabe held her back, grabbing both shoulders.
Thursday night.
The woman seemed to know the routine. Pearson looked at Conway, but he was focused on the neighbor now.
Yes, it would have been Thursday night. Did you see anyone?
See? No, I didn't see them, but I heard them. I hear them every Thursday.
She said this with amusement.
If you're looking for him, though, he's not here. He's never here on the weekends. Something about his job. I think he works here but lives somewhere else. Comes and goes during the week. I have a key. I bring up his mail from the box downstairs. It's mostly junk, but it fills up fast in those small boxes, and then the manager gets pissed off.
Rosie shuddered. This was him. It had to be. Thursday nights. Women.
Can you open it?
Rosie asked.
Conway jumped in before the woman could answer. That won't be necessary.
But the woman was already walking toward 2L, looking through the keys on her chain.
I don't mind, she said. He's not home. It's Saturday.
Now Gabe, finally, coming to the rescue.
It's okay if we go in, he said to the officers. He gave consent by giving his key. We're not the police.
Rosie broke free of his hold and rushed to stand behind the neighbor as she slid the key into the lock. Pearson and Conway didn't move. There was nothing they could do to stop her or Gabe from entering that apartment. The door opened. The neighbor walked in, bent down to pick up a few flyers that had been slid under the door. But Rosie was already in front of her, calling her sister's name.
Laura!
Gabe was there now.
Can we look around a little? He asked the neighbor.
Rosie could sense that the neighbor was starting to question her decision to let them in, starting to see that this was not about finding a friend of her neighbor.
Just a little, and quickly, okay?
She said. She sounded nervous.
Laura!
Rosie raced into the living room, spinning around in a circle, then to the bedroom, the bathroom, the closets, opening doors, calling out the name.
Laura!
Gabe stood quietly in the foyer with the neighbor and her dog. Rosie stared at them as the information settled into her bones. This had been everything. Finding the women who knew this man, finding out where he lived. And now, here she was, in the place where her sister must have been, and maybe just hours before. But there was nothing. No signs of her sister, no signs of a struggle, not even a glass in the sink.
The cleaning service comes on Fridays, the woman said. Do you want the name?
Gabe said something. The woman said something back. She pulled out her phone. He pulled out his phone. But none of it mattered. If the cleaning people had seen something wrong, they would have called the police. And if they didn't think what they found was wrong, they would have cleaned it up and erased it forever. All evidence of her sister. Gone.
Gabe!
Rosie cried out. She could feel the tears sting her dry skin. The woman stood against the open door.
I think I should lock it up, she said. I have Eddie's number. I can call him for you.
Gabe walked the few steps to Rosie and pulled her in tight.
It's okay, he said. This is good news. Nothing happened here. Look. Nothing happened.
Rosie looked up and found his eyes.
There was a number, she said in a whisper, on the list. Calls and texts going back weeks. There are so many of them.
What number?
Gabe asked. But she choked on the answer.
Rosie, what number is it?
He asked again.
Joe's. It's Joe's number.
Chapter 34. Laura. Session number 12. 2 months ago. New York City. Dr. Brody.
Calm down, Laura. I've never seen you like this.
Laura. No, you need to tell me right now, right this second. Dr. Brody.
It's complicated. I wanted you to be ready to understand.
Laura. We're past that, Kevin. I need to know. Just tell me. Stop treating me like a patient. Dr. Brody.
Laura, that's not fair.
Laura. You said I'd do this to myself, to prove a point. You said I would come to know what that meant. What fucking point I'm always trying to prove. Dr. Brody.
Okay, just calm down. You're distraught. What's brought this on?
Laura. Just tell me. Dr. Brody.
Fine. You want to know what point you're always trying to prove to yourself, with scores of men who will never love you, who probably can't love anyone, and why you throw yourself at them and let them into your mind and your heart and your body?
Laura. Yes, tell me why I do all of those disgusting, reprehensible things that you obviously think are unworthy of your pristine self-awareness. Dr. Brody.
You are unlovable.
Laura. What? Dr. Brody.
The point you try to prove to yourself over and over so you can feel as shitty as you have your whole life. So you can be sure to repeat the past until you're dead and buried, never changing, never moving forward. Laura Lochner, men don't love you in spite of everything you give them because you are unlovable. Are you happy now? Now that you know?
Laura. Jesus Christ, Kevin. Dr. Brody.
But it's not true. It's never been true. That's what I wanted you to understand. That this truth you keep trying to prove over and over is a lie. You are lovable. And I love you, Laura. I love you.
Laura. Kevin.
Dr. Brody. Tell me what happened. Tell me why you're so upset.
Laura. I can't. I promised.
Dr. Brody. Whom did you promise?
Laura. Joe. I promised Joe. My sister's husband.
Chapter 35. Laura. The night before. Friday, 1 a.m. Branston, Connecticut. Jonathan eats pizza. He eats it standing at the kitchen counter, without a plate or a napkin. He found a beer in the back of the fridge, and he split it in two. A glass for me, and what was left in the bottle for him. He eats the pizza and drinks the beer like he hasn't a care in the world beyond hunger. He groans with satisfaction.
Oh my God, he says. What is it about late-night pizza?
I've joined him on the other side of the counter, but I can't manage to eat because I've already downed a plateful of anxiety. I drink the beer.
I'm sorry, I say.
He looks at me and shrugs.
Don't worry about it. I'm sure I'll finish the leftovers tomorrow.
Not about the pizza. About everything else. I think about the everything else as I say the words, and a shudder rolls through my body. Everything else. A, freaking out in his car and running through the park. B, revealing my dark, twisted past. C, seducing him. D, freaking out in his kitchen. And E, accusing him of numerous crimes he didn't commit. He looks at me with a wry smile this time, and I can't stand how cute he is. His shirt hangs loosely now, sleeves rolled up, two buttons undone at the top. His hair is disheveled from my hands, my fingers running through it. And I want to do it again. Touch his hair, touch his chest, his back, his face. I've spun around in circles as conclusions have come and gone, pulling me in sharp turns. It's made me dizzy. It's made me spent. I want to fall into his arms and let it all pour out of me until I'm fast asleep. Finally, my mind at rest.
I kind of like the everything else, he says between bites. Some of it more than the rest, but that's the way life is, right?
It's hard for me to believe in his kindness, but I do. I force it down my throat and swallow it because I will not repeat the past. Not anymore. And because I can't make one more turn. I probably started dating again too soon, I say. This is now damage control. If he opened me up and saw what was inside my head, he would shove me out the door and turn the bolts.
After the bad breakup? He asks.
I nod yes, but then also no. It's more than that. I learned some things over the summer, about myself and my childhood, things that I'm still sorting out. He drops a piece of crust into the box and picks up a fresh slice.
Well, since this is technically our second date, let's hear it. All of it, he says. Tell me what you learned this summer that you can't sort out.
I lean against the counter, bare feet planted firmly on the linoleum floor. It's about my father, and my mother, really.
You said your father cheated and then left all of you for another woman. You haven't seen him for 16 years, right?
We were supposed to go for weekends, up to Boston twice a month. Rosie went until she was 17, but I refused. I could see it made my mother happy when I did, and Dick never pushed it. At least that's what I was told. Your father said you can go if you want, but you don't have to. I think it would have been different if Rosie had refused.
Why? Did he love her more?
I look at him now with profound curiosity. It's such a horrible question, and yet also dead on. I like how smart Jonathan is, and how honest. Yes, I think, he is honest.
He offered to show me, to find himself on the internet, to pull up emails. But I've done enough damage tonight. I'll have time tomorrow. I'll have all day because Rosie will wake me up, sneaking in my room to make sure I'm all right, the door squeaking, the floor creaking. She can't help herself. Yes, I answered just as boldly. He loved her more. I've just recently been able to admit it. I had to be shown. I had to have the evidence laid out before me. I tell him then about the picture I found in a box my mother sent me when she moved to California. It has all of my old junk from my room, plastic trophies and medals, art projects, letters I wrote home from summer camp, and pictures. I made it my screensaver, I tell him. He stops eating and leans against the counter next to me.
Wait. You took the one photo from that box where you can actually see the sadness on your face, your little childhood face, sad because you knew your father loved your sister more, and you put it in a place where you had to look at it every day.
I laugh a little because he's right. It is absurd. Except that it also makes perfect sense. I didn't want to forget. I wanted to see that face looking at my father behind the camera and know beyond any doubt that it lives inside me.
That's horrible, he says. It's so sad. I'm sorry, Laura. Really, I can't imagine thinking that my parents didn't love me. Even when my sister and I complain about the terrible things they did as parents.
Was your mother late to pick you up from soccer practice?
All the time. How did you know?
We both smile now.
But even when we complain about those things, there's never a question about whether they loved us.
I think to myself how normal that must be, how most adults in our world, the world of the privileged, take this for granted. And I realize how hard it is for me to imagine it. I'm happy for you, I say. And I'm happy for Rosie. I go on then with these things I learned from Dr. Brody, how I choose men who would never love me, so I could repeat the past, craving that feeling that was so familiar, craving the chance to finally be enough to fix him and make him love me. How I did that with Mitch Adler. It struck me one day in the West Hotel, lying in bed with Dr. Brody, Kevin, after making love, feeling safe and protected. We spoke of these things, and I suddenly realized that all of these pieces fell into place, that Mitch was dead because they did. I don't tell Jonathan about Dr. Brody or how I came to understand all of these things about myself. And I don't tell him about Joe and the secret we now share. I only say that I figured it out and that I now feel responsible for Mitch. He wouldn't have been in that car with me if I had done what any normal girl would have done, if I'd told him to go straight to hell when we were kissing behind a tree. Jonathan is quiet suddenly, and it has me unnerved. Something about Mitch Adler gets under his skin. Maybe because he can't believe he's here with me, the woman who might have killed someone, or because it reminds him of the man who drowned when he was in high school, or maybe because of something else, something I can't even imagine. And I have a very colorful imagination.
Are you wondering if I'm one of them? Jonathan says after a little while. One of your wrong men.
Now it's my turn to be honest. I wouldn't know if you were. That's the problem now. It's like knowing you're colorblind and then someone asks you the color of the leaves on the trees.
So you gather evidence. Is it spring or fall? Are they maples or oaks? Why is he driving that shitty little car?
I answer with a nod and a smile as I stare at my naked toes.
If it makes you feel any better, I do that more now. Now that I've been dating for a while on that godforsaken website, everyone lies. You have to read between the lines, look for clues hidden in photos. Sometimes you don't know until you meet face to face.
Or you Google them and hope they've used their real names.
Aha, he says. But you did it too, Laura Hart.
Yes, I did.
So where does that leave us?
He asks. I don't know. He slips an arm behind my back and pulls me into him. Our bodies press together as we lean against the counter. His body is warm and strangely familiar now. I wrap my arms around his neck and rest my cheek against his chest. I hear his heart beating and it soothes me. But then everything changes.
I think,
he says, moving one hand down my thigh until it finds the hem of Rosie's dress. Then it moves beneath the fabric, up and up and inside. He whispers in my ear,
I think we should fuck again.
His voice is deep and lurid, and it sends my body into lockdown. Every muscle stiffens against the pull of his hands on my dress and my hair. His mouth is wet, kissing my neck, devouring me suddenly like he devoured that pizza. What is happening? The question has nowhere to go for an answer. It searches for the place where instinct should be, where reason should sound out, and finds an empty hole. This is my defect. This is my Achilles heel. All I can do is look at the evidence. Where is the kindness? Where is the honesty? I've just stripped my soul bare. I've told him how vulnerable I am to this very thing, to uncertainty about men, to regret, and to the violence that resulted years ago. He says it again.
I want to fuck you right now.
And I feel my hand squeeze tight, a ball of stiff, folded fingers, nails digging into my palm. A fist. I open my eyes when he moves his head away, and I see my purse on the counter. I have one thought now, one thought about what I have to do. Run. Maybe this is nothing, I know that. Some people like this, the physical passion, the verbal vulgarity. But it stands beside the soft touch of his hands less than an hour before. It stands beside the intimate conversation that has barely ended. I don't have the tools to understand. I have to go, I say. Though the words are not easy to get out, that sad child, that stupid child, does not want to disappoint him. I hate her. She never listens. He doesn't stop, so I say it again, fueled by anger now. I have to go. I push him off me and grab my purse. I reach inside and look for my keys. Jonathan stands still. He seems embarrassed, but I don't care. I don't care if he was trying to be seductive or sexy or whatever. I have to leave.
Laura, he says, I'm sorry, did I misread something? I thought we were really connecting.
Fuck, where are my keys? My hand brushes a piece of paper, and I remember the same feeling from earlier, from before I lost control, got in his bed, found his ring. I grab it this time and pull it out. It's heavy. And when it is freed from my purse, my keys fall out from between the folds. Jonathan reaches down to pick them up, and I hate him for doing it, for being nice again. So much hatred runs wild. Who are you, Jonathan Fielding? I unfold the paper. It's just like the others. One sentence typed in black ink. Only this one scares me even more. This one is not a threat. It's a conclusion.
What is that? Jonathan says. What does it say? You just turned as white as a ghost.
I look up from the note. I don't need to read it again. They're words I will never forget. So I just say them as I stare at this stranger. You should have left while you had the chance.